Clay, my clock says 9 o'clock. I know people are still going to be coming on, but it's time to begin. This will be the first of our talks on the Chasam Sofer, or Moses Schreiber Sofer. We have three more classes this semester. Before I do that, though, I have a whole pile here of things I wanted to get to. So before we start with the Chasam Sofer, which is going to take us a number of weeks, let me quickly go through. This relates to things that people sent me, things I wanted to point out, updates to previous classes. So let me begin. The first one is we had some talk last class about Shalom Zachar and its origin. I looked, and any of you can look on your own, in the Otsar Dinim U'Minhagim, Judah Eisenstein, and you can see in there that there's already references to this in the Rishonim. He quotes the Trumos HaDeshen, he quotes the Tor, etc. So it's a much older practice than an Upshara. Here I have, you can see the way this, how the book looks. This is how, if you order books from HebrewBooks.org, soft cover or even hardcover, it's this color and they bind it and send it to you. I'm holding in my hands Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson's commentary on Tractate Horayot. It's volume 1, page 9a. We had discussion when we dealt with Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson about the idea that if enough people stop following a halakha, can it be voided then by a Beis Din? And you see he has a nice discussion of that there. And he says that even though technically you actually need a Beis Din to void it, this, the fact that it can be voided explains why the great rabbis of America in the early part of the 20th century didn't protest when many people violated certain sins, because everyone was doing it. And if there was a Beis Din, the Beis Din would have found a way to permit it. Now, enlarge my picture. Fits here. I'll move it over a little bit if I can. And then I'll make it a little bigger, because some people have asked for me to make it a little bigger. So let me try this now. Okay, that way I can still open up the pictures. We don't really have many pictures but today, but if I needed to. In fact, let me just see for a minute what happens if I do that. Okay, so I'm going to have to close myself up if I do that. Here I'm holding another book of Rav Chaim Hirschenson, Berurei Hamidot, and in the English section, this is interesting. It speaks about, if you recall, we dealt with Chaim Hirschenson, that he, together with Ben Yehuda, were the first peoples to really start Hebrew language, the Hebrew language, spoken language, and his daughter was the second child raised in a Hebrew-speaking home. In the introduction, the English introduction, it speaks about how his daughter, whose marriage took place at Sherith Israel in New York, when she married Rabbi DeSova Poole, who was the rabbi there. Ben Yehuda was in America, and he attended the wedding, and he says to Chaim Hirschenson, "You have won me over, that is. Throughout our comradeship, you preached to me belief in God, and I preached radicalism. Now I end with believing in Providence. Your aim in life to unite the past and present, orthodoxy and modern life has been accomplished in this beautiful synagogue, and it's truly Jewish tradition. Ben Yehuda, who never wept, had tears in his eyes." So assuming this testimony is correct, at the end of his life, Ben Yehuda moved away from his radicalism and into more of an appreciation for tradition. Many months ago, we dealt with the question of unmarried women going to the mikvah. And I said that I find it hard to, obviously you have, they won't permit it as a policy, but if someone, a woman comes, they will permit it if it's done quietly, or if she goes, if no one knows her, she goes to a different city. And I'm holding up this book here, Mayan Omer. This is volume 7. These are questions that Rav Ovadia Yosef is asked. And he answers not long responsa, but at the bottom of the page, the editor gives all the halakhic sources. And on page 2:34, he is asked this very question about women coming to the mikveh who are not married, and he says that the mikveh lady should just ignore it, or halvim ayin, and let them do what they want. On page 261, he says that we can't publicly announce this and tell people to do this. However, we can't teach them even, he says, that in a public fashion, he's referring to here, he was asked by this Baal Tshuva organization, Arachim, that all the unmarried women should go to the mikveh. However, if they do it, and I think he would agree even privately teaching, you should not say anything and not prevent them. A couple more things. Last week, I mentioned to you, who called my attention to Rabbi Zilberstein's book, and I told you there was another strange story about rabbis who are sort of unaware of what's going on in the world, even in their own world, because they're learning so much. It's in Tuvcha Yabiyu. Oh, yeah, it was Rabbi Yonason Rosslyn. That's right. In volume 1, and at page 38, I told you with the story of the Nesivos, that how it is that he and his father have the same name, because the father was so involved in his learning that when he was asked name of the son to give the name, he thought he was being asked the name. But it gets better, because right before this, it has a story from contemporary times where someone in B'nai Brak, when he was asked to give the name of a daughter to be named on Shabbos, he was so involved in his thoughts, his learning, that he gave the name of another daughter of his, and he forgot that he already gave that name to a daughter. Now, like I said, I don't believe this story is true, but as Rabbi Rossman points out, the fact that it's recorded is more significant. A couple more things just to catch us up. Nachum Kagan, who's not live with us but listens online, he also gives a Daf Yomi Shir in Long Island. You can listen to it. He sent me from the latest Jewish Review of Books a very nice article about Chaim Grada. I can send anyone a PDF who's interested in. There's a story here of Grada and the Chazon Ish, his relationship to the Lubavitcher Rebbe a bit. How Leviant, who was the translator for Grada, asked him when he saw that Chaim Grada went to a Seder. And Grada supposedly is such a secularist. What's he doing going to a Seder? And Grada replies, you think I'm a guy? I wouldn't go to a Seder? Leviant is a great translator, not just of Chaim Grada, and he's written his own books. He also translated Yudel Rosenberg from both Toronto and Montreal, his book on the Maharal that made the Maharal famous, the book on the Maharal and the Golem. So for those who are coming with us on a trip to Europe this summer, we'll deal a lot with Yudel Rosenberg. The whole notion of the Golem that everyone knows is here to protect the Jews, this sort of thing. This all comes from Yudel Rosenberg's forgery. Although I don't think it's a forgery. I think he leaves hints that you know that it's not a forgery. Many people assume it's real, and other people assume it's a forgery. I think it's a creative fiction. For those who don't know, he wrote this book, he claimed that he was using this Maharal's son-in-law's manuscript for all these stories about the Maharal and the Golem. Three or four more things here. Let's get to them quickly. New book appeared on Rabbi Soloveitchik, Divrei Harav, from Rav Herschel Schechter. On page 39, he quotes something that I would have loved to have been able to quote last semester when we dealt with Chaim Ozer. He quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik as saying that once when he was together with Chaim Ozer, they started talking about the possibility of a Jewish state in the land of Israel. Chaim Ozer puts out the palm of his hand and says, hair will grow in this place, that is the palm of his hand, before there will be a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And Rabbi Chaim Ozer, as Rosh Hashanah points out, was particularly expert in political matters. And even he was so wrong about that matter. Finally, I'll save the rest, two more things, and I'll save the other ones for a future class. I have some stuff. Let me do it here, because someone, Chaim Malk, sent it to me. So I'll talk about that as well. Chaim sent me here. I have some stuff I want to show you about the some people have asked me about the size of tzitzis. Okay, I'll get to all that next class. I'll just end with what Chaim Malk sent me, that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein has a son, Yitzchak, who's became a Haredi, and he's a rabbi now, Staten Island, and he sent out a memo to his shul that this year there would not be a special reading of the Torah, a special Shalom Zachar, Parsha Zachar reading for the women after davening, apparently, until this year they did have a special reading. And that's relevant to what we spoke about last class, that how Ramosha Feinstein thought it was perhaps problematic, although I think most shuls do it. It is the minhag, first of all, for women to come to hear Parsha Zachar, even though, like I mentioned, this is the first one to mention this is Rabbi Nassim Haber, who we're speaking about very soon. And I don't know why Ramosha Feinstein, he says that a public reading without the three Aliyahs is problematic. I'm not sure what's problematic. The Bar Mitzvah boys take out the Torah and read it. You can take out the Torah and learn from it. So I don't know what would be problematic. His other point, this is a feminist sort of, it goes against Minhag Yisrael. That's different. Maybe that's Rabbi Lichtenstein's justification. I would like to think, however, that if Rabbi Lichtenstein is telling the community that they're not going to have a special reading of Parsha Zachar, that he's also telling the community that women are not really obligated according to the mainstream view, even though it's the Minhag, because it would be a little unfair, I think, to tell all the women that they have to come hear it, and at the same time not have the extra reading, because then what are the women supposed to do? Many times they're left with the kids and they have to get them dressed, so I don't know. And finally, Bill Gewirtz, well, he's not here with us, so I will save when he comes back something he commented. If anyone has any questions, and when I just said I got about halfway through, I have some good stuff about Frankfurt, various minhagim in Frankfurt, which we dealt with in the past, so we'll get to that hopefully next class. Let us now turn to Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer. We are dealing with, when we deal with the Chassam Sofer, perhaps the most important rabbi in the last 200 years. Who would measure up against him? Maybe Rav Kook, perhaps Rav Ovadia Yosef. I can't think of anyone else who would be in their league. And I don't think that either of them really are as significant as the Chassam Sofer. Some have even called him the first Orthodox Jew. What does that mean, the first Orthodox Jew? We will soon see when I discuss what Orthodoxy is. We've spoken about it. But we'll get to it again, the difference between Orthodoxy and traditional Judaism. One author even wrote an entire book arguing that he was, the book is titled From the Chassam Sofer to Herzl, seeing the Chassam Sofer as a proto-Zionist. And we will see as well that there's what to be said for that. Basically, the Chassam Sofer is all things to everyone, from the most extreme Eda Haredi Hungarian extremist, they look to him. He had followers of Torah Derech Eretz type philosophy, religious Zionist. Rav Kook was a great admirer of the Chassam Sofer. Actually, I can't find it, but get it maybe next class. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook was a great admirer of the Chassam Sofer. And we'll see why this all is soon. I don't need to give any more words of introduction. I think his great significance will be seen as we go through the classes. I don't know how many classes we will have of the Chassam Sofer. It will definitely be more than five. More than we had on the Stipler and Eliezer Berkovitz. We could have 20 classes. Literally, we could have 20 classes on the Chassam Sofer, and we still have a lot more to do. We won't have 20 classes. But we will have a significant amount of classes because the issues we deal with will be so wide-ranging. For example, we're going to have to deal with the rise of Reform and the Chassam Sofer, who led the battle against Reform. He's the one that created the response to Reform. So therefore, we need to understand what the Reform movement was, where it came from. Especially the Reform movement that the Chassam Sofer was dealing with tried to be halakhic Reform. So we'll deal with that as well. Now, some people do look at the Chassam Sofer as some sort of reactionary, both admirers of the Chassam Sofer and opponents of the Chassam Sofer. He's the great you know, the boogeyman, the one who the non-Orthodox like to turn to as the worst side of Orthodoxy, because of his famous expression, Chadash Asur min haTorah, whatever is new is forbidden from the Torah. Many people, that's all they know about the Chasam Sofer. We will, however, discuss what this means and show that viewing him as a reactionary does a great disservice to the man. First of all, the very this Chadash Asur min haTorah, everything that's new is forbidden from the Torah, is not exactly his philosophy. In fact, it's far from his philosophy. He's only with regard to the Reform movement that he used that expression. And actually, the first time he used it wasn't even with regard to the Reform. It was used to criticize a turn to Chumra, to stringency. So already you see that it's a false vision of him as some sort of reactionary. In some areas, he was quite conservative, we will see. In other areas, he was not conservative. So as I said, it shouldn't surprise us that he had extremist students, Raphael Lichtenstein, Chaim Sofer, and others, but he also had students who are quite liberal, with a Torahim Derech Eretz perspective. And he had plenty of students like the Maharam Shik and his son who were right in the middle. The fact that one of the earliest biographies of the Chasam Sofer was written by Isaac Hirsch Weiss, who was one of the leaders of Wissenschaft, of scholar, academic Jewish scholarship, shows that even the non-Orthodox were attracted to him. Now, the Chasam Sofer never published anything in his lifetime. Anything significant, no books. So his influence was a personal one. And when you deal with personal influence, different people will be affected differently. Let me just give you an example to show you how complicated this whole thing is. And we'll soon see more. The Chasam Sofer holds that in the, and he writes this in his commentary on Tractate Sukkah, that in the land of Israel, there is no concept of Torah only, of only learning. That is a Chutz La'aretz thing. But in the land of Israel, you must also work the land. This is part of Yeshiva Aretz. This is the exact thing the Rav Kook said, that the Yeshiva world outlook, the worldview, the idea of Torah only, that you sit and study all day, Rav Kook said that's a Golus thing. That's how we lived in the Golus. But now that we're coming back to the land of Israel, you need to be people, not just the spiritual, but also the physical. The Chasam Sofer says the exact same thing. According to the Chasam Sofer, just like you can't say that I'm learning now, so I can't put on tefillin because I'm busy learning, you can't say that I'm learning, so I can't be involved in Yishuv Aretz, living in the land. And don't tell me, the Chasam Sofer says, that you're living in the land if you're learning Torah. According to the Chasam Sofer, Yishuv Aretz, living in the land, which is a great mitzvah, the Chasam Sofer was a great follower of the Ramban. The Chasam Sofer is really the one who probably made the commentary of Ramban on Chumash a weekly thing for so many people, because he focused on it and was very devoted to it. And the Ramban, as we know, counts living in the land of Israel as one of the 613 mitzvot. The Rambam doesn't. Chasam Sofer said, however, that Yishuv Aretz, living in the land of Israel, is not living in the land, just living in the land. It means working the land, building up the land, making it a place that you can live. It's not just sitting there and being supported by charity, as was the way of people in the land of Israel. They were supported, the Ashkenazim, not the Sephardim, they were supported by the Chalukah. The Chasam Sofer says that Yishuv Aretz Yisrael means actively living in the land. And I think today, it wouldn't just be he's speaking about working the land, a farmer, things like that. It also means, you know, working at your computer, you know, being involved productively, being a giver, not just being a taker. The Chasam Sofer says you do not fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael if you're just taking, not giving. Avadi says that the Avnei Nezer has responsum also. You know, I'm not sure. I don't remember. The Avnei Nezer has a famous responsum against the notion of the critic, the great critic of the Ramban is the Megillas Esther and a Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Megillas Esther says that there is no mitzvah of living in the land of Israel until the temple is rebuilt. And that's the position adopted by the Munkacher and the Satmar Rav. And it's a minority position, obviously. And the Avnei Nezer, if I recall correctly, I will, actually I will get it next class. Send me an email if you don't mind, Avadia. And I will get the tshuva. If I don't recall the Avnei Nezer saying that, but the whole tshuva is devoted, or parts of it are devoted to that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah even today. So he might discuss it. here's one of the tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer, which I think many of his own followers don't really follow. And the Chasam Sofer, we will see, was also a great mekil, very lenient in many areas of halacha, as are all great poskim. Yes, we will see chumrot. However, the chumrot of the Chasam Sofer are concerned with modernity, with the reform movement, and these were emergency measures. The Chasam Sofer himself says that these are emergency measures, that we have to do these things because of the circumstances we're in. He was not a machmir. On the contrary, he was a great mekel, especially in Yoredei and Eben Ezer. Let me give you some other examples to show you that he was not an extremist in any way, by any stretch of the imagination. And as we go through the course, you'll see examples, and as I said, we will also see why he got this reputation. The Chasam Sofer said that for those people in Hungary who were studying Torah full-time, they are not to be included as soldiers. There were times when there was a draft and the community had to put forth people to be soldiers. However, the Chasam Sofer rejects the notion that when the community has to find soldiers for the army, let's say the government says, this city you have to provide, let's say 10, and another city has to provide 15. They did it depending on the population, and it was up to the community to supply it. The Chasam Sofer says that the community cannot just pick the non-religious. There were many who thought, including rabbis, that okay, if we have to pick some people to serve as soldiers, let's pick the non-religious. They're not Shomer Shabbos anyway, and they're not so valuable to us. People who are valuable are religious Jews. The Chasam Sofer rejects that completely. He thought that you have to have a lottery. Everyone has to be part of a lottery. This position was actually held by his predecessor, Rav Meshulam Igra. I go to Pressburg this summer, and I talk a lot about Rav Meshulam Igra. When he was in the Ukraine, this wasn't, this was before there was the Cantonists. This is an issue that came up with Tsar Nicholas, I believe 1829, when he institutes he starts drafting Jews. He had these Cantonist regiments. Which everyone was drafted for, was for 25 years. Now, Jews were always exempt, but then Jews started being included. So the draft was at 18, and you'd serve for 25 years. And then you had non-Jews do it also, but it was always the poor people. And in the non-Jewish community, the government itself picked who it was. However, in the Jewish community, they gave it to the Jews to pick. And for the Jews, it was worse, because there was also 5 years or 6 years before 18, from the age of 12, and for those 6 years, you were placed with a non-Jewish family, and the idea was to turn you into a Christian in those 6 years, and that's what happened to most of them. After 6 years, from 12 to 18, and sometimes, by the way, it was before 12, and then you served 25 years. It's a miracle that anyone was still Jewish after this, but there were some who were still Jewish, and they even set up a synagogue in Helsinki. Now, this was a way to also to destroy the Jewish community. Now, how would the Jewish community get the people to serve? You would say, what should you do? Well, maybe a lottery. That would be the fairest thing. Let's say you're in a town, and the government says to you, come up with five boys, age 12. Five boys between age 11 and 13, whatever they say. You maybe want to do a lottery, but the Jewish community did not do that. What they did was, and this is, I guess, throughout history how it works, the golden rule. If you have the gold, you make the rules. The rich people, in league with the rabbis, there was this unholy alliance between the rabbis and the community leaders. And the rabbis were told that if they don't interfere, then their children will not be drafted. Their sons will be free. Now, I'm not blaming the rabbis. I don't think that, I think you can make the case that in a situation like this, it's every man for himself. You do what you can to save your own family. Rabbi Ephraim Ushri, in his responsa from the Holocaust, deals with the case if the kapos have these white cards, and whoever gets these cards, they have to distribute, let's say it's 30,000 people, and they're distributing 5,000 cards, and whoever gets them stays in the ghetto and stays alive, and everyone else is deported to the extermination camp. Can you grab the cards out of the hands of the kapo? And Rabbi Ushri says, yes, you can. That the couple or the Jewish Community Council, they're going to have a lottery or they're going to do what they want to do. You're not obligated in that. As long as you're not grabbing it out of anyone who has the card already, you're just grabbing the card to save yourself. And therefore, it's every man for themselves. So if the rabbi had a chance to save his child, I'm not criticizing. But there were rabbis who opposed it. There were Rabbi Meshulam Igra. This is before the Cantonist. This is a different type of draft. He was a rabbi in the Ukraine in the early 19th century. He said, we need to have a lottery, and even my son needs to be in it. Tzemach Tzedek spoke out and said everything needs to be fair. There were others, but most rabbis didn't. And what did the community leaders do? They decided, of course, to take the poor kids. Kids who are orphans, who have maybe just a mother, one who they have no one to protect the kids. They hired people, hired either non-Jews or violent Jews, and they were called hoppers, and they would come into the cities, and they would try to surprise, because if the word got to the city that these people were coming, everyone would send their kids to the forest to hide. They would come in, and we have memoir literature describing this. They would just burst into a house, so some kid could be sitting there or sleeping or eating breakfast, and they would grab him, pull him out, take him to the building where they kept them. The mothers could be outside screaming. The next day, they're put on the carriage, and they're off. And it's not like today, the army, where you come back and forth. 25 years, you'll never see your parents again. You're off, you go to Siberia, and you end up marrying during this time. I mean, as you get older, it's basically your life is finished the way you knew it. So the hoppers would come to town and grab the poor kids. This tore Jewish society in Russia apart. We have so much memoir literature, so much written about it. It also, understandably, led to a feeling of anti-clericalism, that the rabbis are in league with the oppressors, which they were in league with the oppressors. Take the poor kids. And you can understand if people were turned off to religion because of that. So that is the Chappers. And the Chassam Sofer opposed this idea that many rabbis even thought halachically this was proper. You take the non-religious kids. Because they've sort of left the community, as it were. When I wrote my book on Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg, I spoke about how he was not the typical yeshiva person. I mean, yeshivas, in theory, were the great equalizer. Anyone yeshiva and excel and then become a rabbi in a community, get a good shidduch. But the fact is that most people, when they finish later at 12 or 13, have to go to work. So who went to yeshivas? Most of the time, it was children of the more wealthier people or children of rabbis. But the poor people, for the most part, didn't go to yeshivas, although there were exceptions. Rabbi Jacob Weinberg was one of these exceptions, that he came from a not undistinguished family. I don't know if they were poor, but they were certainly undistinguished. And I discuss this in the book. Only after the book was published did I uncover something which of great use to me in explaining how undistinguished his family was. Rabbi Yechiyahu Weinberg's grandfather was a Cantonist. He wasn't there for 25 years because when Tsar Alexander came in the 50s, they abolished the Cantonist system. But Rabbi Yechiyahu Weinberg's grandfather was a Cantonist, which shows you how undistinguished they came from, because the rich people, they never had to be concerned with this, because either they would pay off one of the poor families to take their place, to take one of the slots, or most time it was just the hoppers. And the hoppers never went after the rich people, because the rich people determined that their kids were going to be safe, and they sent them after the poor kids. How did I get this? Oh, because Rav Meshulam Igra had the same position as the Chassam Sofer. You don't take the poor kids, you don't take the irreligious kids. The yeshiva kids, the people who were studying Torah full time, which was a tiny amount, they were given the exemption according to the Chassam Sofer, but everyone else, including religious, non-religious, have to be treated equally. Obviously not the language of a religious extremist. People speak in terms of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Everything new is forbidden from the Torah. And as I said, we will deal with this. But one who believed in Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, that everything new is forbidden from the Torah, like the Chassam Sofer, supposedly people say he believed in, which he didn't, would never permit a woman to remarry. If her husband, who's a soldier, was killed, and the only evidence for this is that the army informs her of this, she gets an official letter from the army that your husband is dead. No body, no identification. Someone who believed in Chodesh Hashem and HaTorah would never assume that that's reason enough to allow a woman to remarry, like the Chasam Sofer did. Someone who believed in Chodesh Hashem and HaTorah in an expansive sense never would have permitted one to use an umbrella on Shabbos, like the Chasam Sofer did, where there's an Erev. The great Kanai, the great extremist, the Chasam Sofer, permitted using an umbrella on Shabbos. And I don't know of anyone today who follows this psak. So already we see that he is not an extremist at all. But he did live in an era of great changes, of emancipation, of revolution and reform, of Haskalah, of Hasidut. Traditional Jewish society was being challenged. It was being challenged in all sorts of different ways. I just gave you terms that we're going to deal with that show that it was being challenged. So the traditional world looked to him for answers. Let us begin with the biography, as we always do. I'm asked privately a question, what's the situation for using an umbrella on Shabbos? Well, there's the big machlokas between the Notabi Yehuda and the Chasam Sofer. The Notabi Yehuda felt that it's forbidden to use it. If I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, I have to look this up again. The note of the Yehuda was only talking about, I think, if you open it on Shabbos, but if it's already open on Shabbos, I can't remember now. Someone will have to check it. I can't remember if the note of Yehuda holds that even if it's open on Shabbos, it's forbidden. And the Chasam Sofer writes that it's permitted if it's open on Shabbos. If I'm not mistaken, again, it's been years since I've seen it, he doesn't really see a problem, or maybe it's other Achronim who deal with his position who don't see a problem even opening it on Shabbos. Because we open in baby carriages, they have the umbrella there, and have these tapes that open the umbrellas. Others have said, well, one's permanently fixed, the other's temporary, but one you carry. But if it's not the Chasam Sofer, it's others who say that there's no distinction. But the Chasam Sofer definitely is talking about an umbrella that's already open, because it's not a tent or anything like that. I'm assuming, therefore, that in Pressburg, they carried umbrellas on Shabbos. It is amazing when you think of it that our practice is not to carry an umbrella on Shabbos. The Chasam Sofer was the Gadol Hador, bar none. He was the greatest sage, greatest posek of his generation, and he ruled that you can carry an umbrella on Shabbos where there's an Erev. And today, I don't even think today, if you carry an umbrella on Shabbos, they let you be a witness at a wedding, because they regard it as Chulul Shabbos, which again, if you think of it, incredible. How someone would need to do a study, how it is, because there are poskim, not just Chasam Sofer, who deal with this, how it is that umbrella became so forbidden on Shabbos that it's not like other things. Like, if you're in Borough Park on Shabbos, some people use the Erev, others don't. You have other things, some people will return food to a blech on Shabbos, others won't. I mean, you use a hot plate, you have all different things where there's disputes. This Rav says this, that Rav says that. But the umbrella has pretty much become accepted so that no one will use an umbrella on Shabbos. I even know of a great posek who holds that it's permitted to use an umbrella on Shabbos. This is a Haredi posek, but he tells everyone don't use it, although he thinks it's permissible, but he's not going to matter something that the whole world says is forbidden, but he thinks it's 100% permissible to use an umbrella, but... we're going to see soon. I will show you that the Chasam Sofer holds that Shabbos ends earlier than anyone in the world today ends Shabbos. Shabbos was ended earlier in Pressburg when the Chasam Sofer was there than not only any city in the world today, even than his own followers, the Chasam Sofer and B'nai Brak, who are supposedly, they're called the group of the Chasam Sofer. No one in the world today, including those people who end Shabbos, 45 or 42 minutes after sunset. We're all ending Shabbos later than the Chasam Sofer ended Shabbos. Someone emails me that the Erev in Brooklyn became a rule plus follower of Moshe. Yeah, in Moshe's lifetime, it did become a ruling. That was very short, because when he was passed away, then all of a sudden everyone started carrying. But maybe that's an example of something that in Ramosha's lifetime, he was so powerful. And yes, you point out the Shabbos clock, no one's mentioned. In my classes on Ramosha Feinstein, I dealt with Shabbos clocks. Shabbos clocks was something that no one accepted Ramosha's view. Or how about liquid soap? Liquid soap, Ramosha forbids liquid soap on Shabbos. I don't know how he expects you chemically to keep your hands clean, but even his own family never accepted that. I know that because I asked someone in his family what the family does if they don't use liquid soap, and his answer is he said he doesn't know, meaning that he uses liquid soap on Shabbos. So let me begin with the biography. I see someone. Well, let me get a biography. If someone's typing, we'll go back. Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, Schreiber, was born in Frankfurt am Main in 1762. And he always regarded himself as a Frankfurter, one from Frankfurt. And you can see his letters in responsa. He signs them Moses Sofer from Frankfurt. Even when he was gone from Frankfurt for many years, he signed it this way. He observed that there was a special Purim. It's the 20th of Adar. If any of you are descended from Germans from Frankfurt, the 20th of Adar was a special Purim, a local Purim, they call it, from 1614, when Jews were suffering terrible persecution. And the leader of this persecution was killed by the government. If I'm not mistaken, it was the government that executed him. And this is a special Purim of Frankfurt. The Chassam Sofer would still commemorate this, even when he was out of Frankfurt. Sofer, by the way, is Schreiber. Scribe, a writer. His father was a Sofer. And that's where they got the name from. This was not the original family name, but because of the father's job, they adopted the name. What was the original family name? I haven't been able to find it in the sources, but they do say it wasn't the original. I'll try to see. I have some more sources to see if I can find the original. His early education came from his father. And by the age of 6, he was studying with someone called Rav Meshulam Chassid. I don't know anything about him. Rav Chassid never mentions him. And by age 9, he's with Rav Nosson Adler. This is important. In general, it's important that we think about how old people were when they were studying in certain yeshivas. When we hear about someone studying with so-and-so, sometimes we have the impression that they're in their 20s. They're like yeshiva students today. The Chassam Sofer begins studying with Rav Nosson Adler at age 9. Really a youngster. Rav Nosson does more to shape the Chassam Sofer than anyone else. Even more than the Chassam Sofer's own father. He also studies with Rav Pinchas Horowitz, Hafla, the famous Hafla, known for his commentary on the Talmud, who was the Rav of Frankfurt. When we see, by the way, how old the Chassam Sofer is, when he leaves Rav Nosson, you'll get a good sense. Was the Chassam Sofer, I'm asked, the descendant of the Kos Yeshuos? Maybe that's what the name was. I don't think so. Don't recall that being mentioned. I'm going to talk about another someone he's descended from, but servants, you got the name? How'd you get that name? Tell me how you got the name Shlomo. That service was the family name. From Burak. Okay, there's a. If you have the book, just email. Can you? Does he give a source? I've never used that book. Or is Burak just giving an oral tradition? Stay for Or Yashar. Do me a favor, Shlomo. Email me the source and the page number, and I'll check it. I'm not even sure what Or Yashar is. Actually, it's an early biography of the Chassam Sofer, but I'll check and get that, because the standard biographies, the Chut HaMashulash and all the others, don't mention it. But I will check. It's a very early... it's not a biography, it's a hagiography. So thank you. So we have a name. I don't know about these names. I'll check this to be sure. Like the Vilna Gaon, they often say that his family name was Kramer. In fact, you even have people who think that this Kramer's theorem, this mathematical thing, has something to do with the Vilna Gaon. I don't know if the Vilna Gaon is Kramer. It's said a lot. I've never seen this mentioned in anything I regard as a reliable source. It's certainly never mentioned in his lifetime in any case. he's simply called Eliyahu HaChassid. So it could be there's a source, and so many people say it. I assume there's a source, but I have yet to see a reliable source that his name is Kramer. So I don't know. I haven't investigated it. Don't get me wrong. I haven't actually gone to all the sources and looked into it. But by reading, I've never actually found things. And so you find I have to investigate this if that's really his name. I had never used this book, Burak. He has a book on the Chasam Sofer. It's not a hagiography. It's not a scholarly biography. It's somewhere in the middle, but I'm glad you have it, Shlomo. And truthfully, I'll get a copy of it because it's worth at least looking. What I've tried to do here is actually use the primary sources to try to create the portrait I'm going to give you. I really should look at Burak because it'll make my life easier. So I will get a copy of it. Rabbi Jake Kelman, you know something that I don't know if everyone else knows, which I'm going to talk about in 2 minutes, but it's someone else. It's not the Kos Yeshuos. Oh, wait a second. Unless the Kos Yeshuos is the Marashach. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. It is. It's Shatan. He is the Kos Yeshuos. I know him as the Marashach. That's exactly the person. But he's known as Shatan, and I think Shatan is simply the city name. Maybe that was the name they went by. But I'm not sure if I have to check. I think that might have been his father's mother's father. I'll get to that. I'll find out who it is. But Rabbi Kelman, you know an interesting story we're going to get to in just a minute. It wasn't his grandfather, by the way. It was his great-grandfather. And I'm not sure if it's maternal or not. That is his father's mother, in which case it wouldn't be the name. I will get all this for you next class. Now, the Hafal, the Pinchas Horowitz, was the Rabbi Frankfurt. Now, you're saying to me, Shlomo, it's his father's mother. His father's mother's father. But I think that's a mistake. Yes, so that's his great-grandfather. So there, it couldn't be. It's a different family. Very good. Thank you for confirming this. Good. Some of you know the story. The rest of you don't, so I'll tell the story in a minute. At the age of 13, he went to the nearby city of Mainz. Mainz is one of the important German cities. It's known as Schum, Speyer, Vermeise, and Mainz. Those are some of the important cities. Speyer. Many people think that I'm descended from Speyer because many Shapiros, that's where they come from. But no, my great-grandfather changed the name when he came to Ellis Island because it wasn't originally Shapiro. Then you have Worms, famous city identified with Rashi. You have Mainz. There was just to let everyone keep everyone up to date, people have signed up. The trip is doing very well. We still need more people, so tell everyone you know. We need more Americans. So far, it's more Canadians, so please spread the word. Someone's doing a great job. He's not just the worldwide leader in online Torah education. He's also a leader in recruitment. But if this is a success, and it's a B, and everyone likes it, can do it the next year, and then we'll have to go to Germany. So one of the places we go to, obviously Germany, Eretz Adamim, but it's been so many bad things in our history, but there's many good things as well. And one of the places we'll go to is Mainz, we'll go to Worms and all these things. I remember when I was in Germany, I'm on the train, and we're passing by little towns, Rothenburg. I passed by Rothenburg. For the non-Jews, these things are nothing. And for us, they're so important. So we will go there. But who was in Mainz? There was a Rav named Rav Tevela Shire. I don't know if anyone's heard of him, but he was a significant rabbi. And we're also told that when he was in Mainz, the Chasam Sofer studied science and history on his own, of course. Now, as I said, Rabbi Nassim Adler was the most significant, the most influential teacher. He was a father figure to him. Chasam Sofer lived. And the Chasam Sofer tells us that he carefully looked at everything Rav Nassim did. Well, who was this Rav Nassim? Rav Nassim, let me tell you, he created a big dispute in Frankfurt. He only had a few students. He didn't write anything. He had a small minion. He had a small community. The Dayan in his community was Abraham Geiger's maternal grandfather. Now, there is an attack published on Reb Nosson, published during Reb Nosson's lifetime. And from this attack, we get a sense of what Reb Nosson Adler was doing that created all the controversy. And some of it might be exaggerated, but I don't think so. Well, first of all, Reb Nosson Adler, we know, it says it in the attack, and we know it from other sources, he changed the liturgy. And his minion, they davened Nusach Ari, with all the Kabbalistic things, the Lurianic of... So what's the problem? Big deal. In my town, the Chabad opened up a shul in my town, they daven Lurianic. If I want to open up a minion and have people, I can daven Yemenite, I can daven Sephardic. What's the difference? It's not how it worked in Europe. In Europe, even in a big city like Frankfurt, you'd have one big shul, and everyone had to go to that shul unless you got permission to open up another minion, and everything had to be done in accordance with the nusach and the minhag of the community. When the Hasidim come to town, that's where they were so subversive, because they start opening up their own shuls. But in the traditional European style, there was one shul, often, and then there was a shul maybe for the yeshiva students, and the community had to get permission for anything else. And you couldn't, no sectarianism. They wouldn't allow new sects, different davening. Everything had to be the formal way that it was done in the big shul. We're also told in the attack, Obadiah says that the responsa says he prayed in that nusach for him alone. He changed the nusach. Does it say he changed it, or does it say that, I know the Chasam Sofer says he didn't use it. If I'm not mistaken, there were other people who also prayed it. But yes, it was his version. He changed it, him alone. If it's him alone, then... I have to check the attack, because I think it was more than just him alone. I know the Chasam Sofer never changed it, and Reb Nosson said that I'm certain there were other people who did it as well, and that the official, but I'll check, because I don't know why they would have gotten so upset if it was just him. In this minion also, incidentally, they did Birkas Kohanim every day. Birkas Kohanim in the Galut, in the diaspora, other than Amsterdam, where they do it on Shabbos, and that was started during the Shabtai Tzvi era. This is an influence of Shabtai Tzvi, and it continues to this day, Birkas Kohanim on Shabbos, in the main shul there. But no one does Birkas Kohanim every day if you're Ashkenazi. And there's all sorts of questions, why not? Apparently the Vilna Gaon wanted to start it again, and certain things happened that convinced them not to. In Reb Nosson Adler's minion, they did Birkas Kohanim every day. I guess even if it was only him doing the Lurianic version, this would be problematic, because this is an innovation. And I am certain that if Reb Nosson Adler was doing the Lurianic version, the people who wanted to follow him would have also wanted to do it. But I guess that's correct, because Chasam Sofer does mention that the minion itself would not have been a Lurianic version, but that the minion itself definitely did Birkas Kohanim. Reb Nosson Adler himself actually used the Sephardic pronunciation in his davening. He was taught this by a Meshulach from Israel named Rabbi Chaim Modai, the author of a volume of responsa, Chaim Leolam, and he taught him. It took a while for Reb Nosson Adler to learn this, to study. And I say the Sephardic version, I don't mean just to say the tough instead of stuff, but the ayins and everything else. We also know that Reb Nosson Adler told the women in his community that they had to come here Parsha Zachar, which in those days was quite unusual. Well, other people didn't hold of this. That would have been different. He's the first source for this. According to the attack on him, he also changed the times of Shabbos. He began Shabbos earlier. So you have a community where everyone starts Shabbos at one time, and they would see this as religious upsmanship. The community declares this is when Shabbos starts. And communities were very different. It's not like today. For example, in every community, in a big community like Frankfurt, you had a guy whose job it was. In Frankfurt, you might have had two. When it's time for mincha, they would go and they would knock on your door, tell you it's time for davening. They would knock on your door for shacharis. Everything went according to a certain time. And here he opens up and he has something here. I'll get it next time. He's telling his people that they had to start Shabbos earlier. His followers were more stringent when it came to kashrus and family purity laws. This is undermining the unity of the community in a way that would have been intolerable in a place like Frankfurt. And it would create a separation between Rabbi Nassim Adler and his followers and the rest of the community. So it was viewed as a cult, a sect, and a rebellion against the rabbis. We'll see what happens in a minute, what the community does to Rabbi Nassim Adler, who they think was a pious and holy man. We also know that there was a conflict between the Chasam Sofer and his father, who was himself an educated man. The story told, and the story is a correct story because it's told in this book, Chutam HaShulash, which is told by the Chasam Sofer's grandson. And the information he has from most of the stories comes from his uncle, Chasam Sofer's son, who was the Rebbe of Frankfurt, Rav Shimon Sofer. His father was the Ksav Sofer. The story is as follows. The Chasam Sofer, wise child that he was once delivering a public shiur, public lecture to the community. And he started doing this at age 13. And in the lecture, he said that his grandfather, so-called Mahar Shashach, Shmuel Shatin, Sefer, he just was mentioned by Avadi before, he erred in a certain matter. He said that my great-grandfather made a mistake. Now, some of us might think that this is okay to say, Kinat Sofrim, encourage people to study, but the Chasam Sofer's father, who was the grandson, rebuked him for this. According to one version of the story, he even slapped him, saying, what type of chutzpah you have here, Elisha? That you're criticizing your great-grandfather, you're a kid here, and your great-grandfather was such a great sage, and you publicly are saying that he's wrong? So his father rebuked him, or according to one version, even slapped him. Not unheard of, not something unexpected. Perhaps the father didn't recognize how great his son was, but his father was trying to teach him a lesson that you have to have more respect, especially because it's your family, for your great-grandfather. Rabbi Nassim Adler tells the Chasam Sofer after this not to have anything to do with his father. From that day on, his father died. Chasam Sofer never spoke to his father. We spoke in the last couple of classes about things that are done, that great rabbis' attitudes, which are very difficult for us to grasp, incomprehensible. And here's another one of these examples. Yes, we say that you're supposed to respect your Torah teacher, by which they don't mean your third grade teacher or even your 10th grade teacher. They mean your real Rebbe, your exclusive Rebbe, more than your parents, but the idea that as a young child, if Nassim tells him, cut off all ties with your father, it does seem a bit harsh. In any event, Rabbi Nassim becomes the father figure to the Chasam Sofer. We are told in Chutam HaShulash that the Chasam Sofer always treated his father with kavod, just they never spoke to him again. You could say, well, how did you treat your father with kavod if you never speak to him again? But the book is careful to say, he treated him with kavod, he just never spoke to him. You can see the story told on page 3b and 4a. It says that his son, he did everything he's obligated to, avol diber ito mu'ma ma'yom v'hala. He didn't speak to him again. And that's when he began living with Rav Nassim Adler. This also explains why he traveled to Mainz. I told you before he traveled to Mainz. Because he didn't want to be in a situation where he'd see his father and couldn't speak to him. So he decided to go to Mainz. And that was different sources. Some say 13, other sources say 14. So we see how old he was when this whole business happened. We'll get back to this more. It's hard. I think young man being told this by his Rebbe, you see the influence of a Nosson Adler on him that he says, don't speak to your father again, your father's a bad influence on you. So let's return to Reb Nosson Adler and then we'll return to the Chasam Sofer and Reb Nosson. The community issued a decree that no one could pray in Reb Nosson Adler's minyan, in his house, and anyone who did so would be put in cheirim. This minyan, incidentally, people don't realize this, this minyan, this Reb Nosson Adler's minyan, continued until the Nazi era, which I think is amazing. Returning to Reb Nosson, so the community issues a decree, no, anyone who prays in his minyan will be put in cheirim. Because you're violating the community rules. The community said, shut this minyan down. Reb Nosson refuses to shut it down. They say, anyone who goes there is put in cheirim. Reb Nosson ignores this, as do his followers. Finally, they tell Reb Nosson that if you don't shut the minyan, you are going to be put in cheirim personally. All the other people were already in cheirim because they went to the minyan. But Reb Nosson Adler was such a great tzaddik and a scholar. They didn't want to put him in the cheirim. They wanted to put him out of business by saying, anyone who goes to his minyan, you'll be put in cheirim. And once he saw the people, they didn't listen to the rabbis and understand who they weren't listening to. They weren't listening to great Gedolei Yisrael, powerful people. And they thought that Reb Nosson was more important. So then they told Reb Nosson that they're going to put him in cheirim if he doesn't close the minyan. And it said, by the way, that in order to spare his honor, the rabbis, that is, the Hafla and all the rest, the great rabbis of Frankfurt, they shut down all the other private minyanim. There were other private minyanim in Frankfurt who were associated with the main shul and were following the main shul, but they shut them all down so that it wouldn't be, it would give some honor to Reb Nosson Adler that they weren't just shutting his minyan down. They were saying, now we're going to shut all private minyanim down. And but they did tell Reb Nosson that if he didn't, they're going to put him in cheirim. And according to the biography of the Chasam Sofer and Chutam HaShosh, it was this which convinced Reb Nosson Adler that he didn't want to be put in cheirim. I don't think it's him per se, but he doesn't care if they put him in cheirim. He doesn't accept their authority. But the Chil Hashem, the idea that a rabbi is put in cheirim, and he didn't want the machokas anymore, so he decides to leave Frankfurt. Ovadia says that the Maharam of Rutenberg avoided meeting his father so as not to have halachic issues of kibud avaim, who should respect who. Rav Ovadia actually mentions this also, or his son mentions this in one of his recent books. Now that wasn't, well, it could be that if he see his father certainly thought that he wasn't respecting him. Now you see your father in shul and you don't speak to him. You see your father on the streets and you don't talk to him, obviously any father is going to say, that's not kibud av. So maybe grieving, but the biography doesn't say that. The biography simply says that it was difficult for the Chasam Sofer. It was hard for him. Why assume it's an issue of kibud av? Because they also stressed that he felt he was being mechabed his father. He wasn't saying anything bad to him. He just wasn't talking to him. And, well, that might be strange, but it was difficult for him, so he left. When Reb Nosson Adler decides to leave Frankfurt, where to go? You might think that what community is going to want Reb Nosson Adler? He caused all these troubles in Frankfurt. Well, there was a community. It was called Boscovitz. It was in, so we're going to be going there. It's on our trip. It used to be called Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic. I will tell you a little bit about Boscovitz. This also shows you a different point, that the rabbinic culture is such that you could be a rabbi in Frankfurt and then go to Boscovitz East. You can even then go move on to Eastern Europe into, say, Krakow. We will see that these great rabbis came. In order to be Huda comes from Poland, and then he goes to Prague, and then he wants to become rabbi in Germany. At this time in the 18th century, early 19th century, the rabbinic culture was such that all the rabbis, that all the traditional Jewish societies, be it in Poland, be it in Bohemia, or in Germany, or even in Russia, were really the same sort of rabbinic society. And that didn't occasion any surprise for a rabbi to go from Germany to go to Moravia or to go to Hungary. Later, this will be a problem. Certainly, once in Germany, they begin speaking German instead of Yiddish, and culturally, there's development. But at this early period, it wasn't an issue at all. I see it's already 10, so we will stop now, and I'll take some questions. Next class, I will tell you a little bit about Boscovitz. I'm not going to give it all away, because we're going to Boscovitz this summer, and I want to encourage people to come, because Boscovitz has, just to say, has, for example, one of the most amazing shuls you will ever see. There's no Jews in Boscovitz. No Jews at all. And yet it has one of the most amazing shuls. The government keeps it up. We will talk about the Gedolei Yisroel. I'm not going to tell you in this class, but I will tell people who come this summer, and then I'll tell you afterwards how an amazing story the Chassam Sofer tells about Rav Nosson Adler. Nosson Adler's daughter died in Boscovitz. We will see certain Gedolei Yisroel buried in the cemetery. So, but we will talk beginning next class, Rav Nosson Adler a bit in Boscovitz, and then the Chassam Sofer and Rav Nosson part, go their separate ways. So let's stop here for now. As I said, we're just beginning with the Chassam Sofer. There's a lot to do, and of course we'll see next class, Rav Nosson Adler returns to Frankfurt. What happens when he returns to Frankfurt? So let me just take the questions now. We have two more classes on the Chassam Sofer this semester. Shuli asks, is this the first instance when we see so clearly the modern Haredi modus of replacing a father with a Rebbe? Very good question. I never thought of it. Is that the case, though? In the Haredi world, do people really view their as more important than their father? I'm not talking about who they ask halacha questions to, but came down to father or Rebbe, do they go with Rebbe? Could be some, but... I don't know, because remember, this isn't just saying that your Rebbe is more authoritative on a halachic matter, which is found in the Haredi world, even when you're dealing with fathers who are learned, even rabbis. This is going even much, much further. Someone emailed me that it was more difficult to hear me tonight. Maybe the sound was soft. No one else has emailed that to me, so I'm assuming that maybe your sound was turned down. Someone else apparently had a good connection. Okay, someone checked for us, Avadia checked for us, the Avnei Nezer does agree with the Chassam Sofer that mitzvah of settling in the land, Siddur Dea, Siman 458, part 18, it means working the land, being involved with building up the land. Question is, does he mention, Avadia, does he mention, if you can check in this, does he mention the Chassam Sofer? Does he give this as an original position? Okay, so Eva says that she has some problem with sound. Tech support, we will look into it. If you're wireless, that also could be a problem, but not sure other than that. Okay, two people have a problem with sound. If they don't have any more, say that maybe it's just a little glitch. If other people had a problem with sound, we will need to get to the bottom of this. Yeah, Shlomo, the Gemara says the Rebbe is first because he doesn't just bring you into this world, he brings you into the world to come. That's famous, but what does it mean, Rebbe? It obviously means a Rebbe like Rav Nosson Adler, one really devoted to. It doesn't mean the Rebbes that we have today, where you go for a couple years, but still, that just means that you're supposed to respect him more. My question is that really true in reality? Because at the end of the day, you love your parents in a way that's not acquired. Your Rebbe is someone who you acquire a certain respect and love for. It sort of goes against human nature to love your Rebbe. Parents, or even to respect your Rebbe. Well, maybe not respect, but they're speaking about, the Gemara there is speaking about more than respect. It's speaking about love. It's speaking about who you would save first. I think it really goes against human nature, and so therefore I don't think you find many people, no matter what community, who could honestly say that their feelings towards their Rebbe is more than for a parent. And it could be that Gemara is really talking like a halavai, that this is the way it should be, not really speaking in reality. Okay, so far we have two people with the problem, but that's it. So we'll see if anyone else. It could be, if it's only two people, it could be with your provider, or it could be a problem with on our end. Tech support will look into it. Hold on for a couple more minutes. See some people typing. And someone writes to me that even if some of these stories are not believable, they don't tell the stories about you and me. And that is what we said last class, is what I said at the beginning of this class as well. You were not on when I said it. These stories reflect such a different ethos that even if you can't point to this person or that person about who actually lived this way, they put forth an ideology of how the greats live and how one should live, or something to be admired. What does that mean? So you say we don't have a Rebbe Muvhak today. I don't know exactly what that means. You don't have, yes, everything I said referred to with exclusive or a special Rebbe. And some people say we don't have those Rebbes today. The question is, why don't we have these Rebbes today? Chassam Sofer thought that he had such a Rebbe in Reb Nosson Adler. We have other examples where people thought, Reb Baruch Ben Leibovich thought that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was such a Rebbe. So I don't know what that means, we don't have such a Rebbe. Your average person doesn't have such a Rebbe. Even if you went to YU and you stayed there for 4 years, you were in one shiur for 4 years, so we're not going to say that's your Rebbe Muvhak. But when you have a complete emotional attachment, all of your Torah basically comes from this one person, that's a Rebbe Muvhak. You'd say we get most of our learning from books. Reb Baruch Ben Leibowitz and Chassam Sofer would say, not true. They would say maybe in quantity we get our learning from books, but in quality, we get it from the person. And Reb Baruch Ben would say, I could not understand any of these books without Reb Chaim. So the fact that maybe I only was with Reb Chaim for a few years, everything I now study from the days of Reb Chaim, and everything I now study, how I understand it is dependent on Reb Chaim. So Reb Chaim is in my life every single day. So yes, he is my Rebbe Muvhak. Do you know that Reb Baruch Ben Leibowitz, he was in his 40s, and he'd come and he'd visit Reb Chaim, and he'd sit on his lap? That's a Rebbe Muvhak. Most people don't have a Rebbe Muvhak. But if Rav Schachter is trying to give like a halachic statement that the laws of Rebbe Muvhak don't apply anymore because we don't have a Rebbe Muvhak, in the days of the Chassam Sofer, they had Sfarim also. In the days of Reb Baruch Ben Leibowitz, they had Sfarim also. We have plenty of people who still believe that they have a Rebbe Muvhak. Well, we're going to have to look into it. Okay, now we have more than three, so it's a Chazaka tech support in Relay Kelman, that we have areas where the sound stutters. Maybe we have a bandwidth issue, and we're going to have to look into that. I'm getting a private question that today we have access to more written literature, and that's apparently what Schechter is referring to. But in the days of the Chassam Sofer, you had written literature also. You see stories where people think they have this connection with a personal teacher. We also have to think of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer, when this happened with his father, was 13. A 13 or 14-year-old, they're much more impressionable. Tell an 18 or 19-year-old that they should cut off all ties with their parents, that's different, and most of them wouldn't go along with something like this. But a younger person is more impressionable. I am sure that the opposition to the Chassam, to Reb Nosson Adler, wasn't just over his minion. His father was a member of the Kehillah. It was a significant family. You can be sure that his father went to the Aflah and went to the other Rabbanim and say, look what Reb Nosson Adler is doing. He turned my son against me. I am certain, although this is not mentioned in the literature as the reason for the Chayrim, that these personal issues were part of what turned the community against him. They were saying, look at this guy, Nosson Adler. Not just creating a separate dominion and making all sorts of problems, he's turning children against their fathers. It must have made matters worse in the community. Any final comments or questions? Okay, well, if not, thank you very much. As I say, we are only beginning. It's going to take us a number of weeks, this journey into the life and thought and influence of the person I began by saying is the most important figure. It may be the first Orthodox rabbi. I don't know who would precede him. I'm trying to think of who's an Orthodox rabbi before the Chasam Sofer. And I'll explain in future classes what I mean when I say he's the first Orthodox rabbi, as opposed to simply, and why the Vilna Gaon, or why Rashi, Rambam, why they're not Orthodox. What is it about the Chasam Sofer that a new type of Judaism, a different, it's a new world, it's a world of irreligiosity, and a world that forces need to find ways to support themselves and deal with challenges that no one ever dealt with before. So we will pick up next week. Finally, before we go, Avadia says Rabbi Nathanson. I'm not sure what you mean by Rabbi Nathanson. If you're talking about Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson as an Orthodox rabbi, as preceding him, Rabbi Yosef Shaul is really after him. Their lives coincide, but the Chasam Sofer is older than him. So I'm not sure, but yeah, they live the same time, but the Chasam Sofer is older than him and more distinguished than him. Shaul Nathanson lives on. When did Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson die? You have it on Wikipedia. Pull it very quickly. Died in the 1850s, I think. Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson. Anyone pull it up? I can pull it up very quickly. Yeah, Yosef Shaul Nathanson dies in 1875. The Chasam Sofer dies in 1839. The Chasam Sofer had to deal with an issue of Yosef Shaul Nathanson because Yosef Shaul was accused of plagiarism and it came to the Chasam Sofer. But no, this is a different figure. This is from not just the next generation, it's from two generations. Really. The Chabad of Yehuda is not yet categorized as Orthodox. Orthodox only comes into play when you have reform. So what does that mean? We will deal with reform and we'll see. The Note of Yehuda is still what they call pre-Orthodox. He's in a traditional community. But the end of the Note of Yehuda's life, and the Note of Yehuda is still in a pre-Orthodox, in a traditional community, but the end of the Note of Yehuda's life, you see the beginnings of the breakdown, and we'll get to that as well. I'll explain what I mean by Orthodox next class. For now, or when we get to the reform, for now, just remember the following. You can't have Orthodox unless you have reform. Orthodoxy is a response to reform. The Chasam Sofer is the one who crafts this. When you were in an Orthodox community, you need to, halacha is different than when you were in a traditional community. The Chasam Sofer is going to explain why certain things have to be done differently when you're in a community that you are the minority, or you're in a community where you have important people trying to tear down Torah and mitzvos. It is not a traditional community. Things that could go in a traditional community can't go. And we will speak about this ideology of orthodoxy, which the Chasam Sofer is really, I think he's the originator of it. If not the originator, the one who really stands at the forefront of it. Glenn, if you want the sources, I'm using an umbrella, just send me an email and I will send it to you. If I'm not mistaken, it's even in, we have an expert on Rav Avadia Yosef here, also named Avadia. In the next minute we're on here, if at the top of his head, I think there's a tshuva even in Yechava Das of Avad Yosef, and he'll cite all the sources dealing with an umbrella.